From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome back to the show. My name is Noel.
Our compatriot Matt is away but will return soon. They call me Ben. We're joined as always with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deckett. Most importantly, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. This episode will be of particular interest to our fellow conspiracy realist out west in Nevada. It's pronounced a couple of different ways. Noel, you're a Nevada guy, right?
You know, I don't have occasion to say it super often, I guess, but now that I'm thinking about it, I am. Yeah, Nevada. Nevada feels like a Midwestern thing for some reason to me.
The first person I met from Nevada was adamant that it was pronounced Nevada. So we're just going to get that out of the way. The subject of today's episode. This is something different. It takes place in the great state of Nevada, but it raises a question that we've talked about off air when the news hit earlier this year. And our big question, well, we touch on several important things here regarding some of the state's plans. And we're asking whether this is a step into a bold new era of human governance, or if it's a step toward a bold new era of sci-fi dystopia, or if it's in fact a return to conspiracies we have seen in the past. We're talking about something you may have heard of. They have a relatively innocuous name. They're called Innovation Zones.
Mm-hmm. Those sound great. What's wrong with that? Innovation sounds good. A zone. You know, I want to live there. That sounds cool.
Yeah, it reminds me of Discovery Zone.
That's exactly right. Are there trampolines? That's what I want to know. If there's trampolines, I'm in.
There may be. If you can count a new type of trampoline as innovative technology, We'll find out. Like, the thing is, for a lot of people outside of Nevada, when you think of the state, you probably think of one city immediately: Las Vegas. Vegas, baby, city of sin. We've all been there. You've been to Vegas, right?
No. You know, I've not been to Vegas, Ben. Uh-huh. I feel like I'm missing out, or at least I'm out of the loop in terms of the conversation. But I have seen Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and other Vegas-centric movies, so I kind of get what it's about. You know, casino, pretty much like that, right?
Yeah, you've got it. It's Vegas is an incredibly fascinating town on a number of levels because it's one of those cities that only exists at the size it does due to human ingenuity. Mm-hmm. You know, if we didn't have the Hoover Dam, we didn't have all the infrastructure that people have created, then a city of Vegas's size, located where it is located, would simply not be possible. And it's unique. Nevada itself is unique in a number of different ways. You know, parts of the state have legalized sex work, right? That's a big business. Mm-hmm. Gambling laws, of course, are different in Vegas. And one thing that we can assure you, and anyone who's been to Vegas can assure you, is the city never really sleeps downtown. Those casinos are always running. You want to find a blackjack game? It doesn't matter if it's 4 a.m. There's somebody there.
Yeah, and I think this is a really good parallel for what we're talking about today. The idea of creating an entire city around a particular industry, and even like, you know, gaming, for example, and like the gaming commission and all of that. It's so important, you know, like for a new casino, you know, this is everything I know here. I've learned from like the movie Casino and stuff, but things like it, but it's really important to be able to get that license, you know, to get that gaming license so that you can start your casino. And it's like you said, Ben, the city would not exist if it were not for, you know, man-made infrastructure and also this very singular industry. So what we're talking about today, and this is like, you know, been historically the bread and butter of the entire state of Nevada. Nevada? Now I'm flipping it too. I'm confused. But what are we're talking about today is something new. It's not new in concept, but it's something new for Nevada. And it's something, like you said, Ben, called innovation zones.
Yeah, to get our minds around this concept, first we need to talk about some background, because like Nevada, the U.S. is itself somewhat unique, especially during the time of its formation. It did some things that other countries at the time were not doing. Here are the facts.
So back in the 1770s, when the United States were formed, the founders instituted this concept that remains very important today, with varying degrees of actual enforcement, I would argue. The idea of separation of church and state, meaning that the U.S., unlike many other countries, would not have an official state religion and not be able to, like, you know, force any kind of religious views or practices on individuals, specifically in government, in, you know, state sponsored institutions. There would be no allowance for mandatory kind of enforcement of any kind of religious faith, any kind of faith based anything. Though we know in practice that isn't always the case, you know, in terms of like school prayer and even some religious language and things like the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, and this has always been a bit of a gray area. But the tax part of it is probably the most interesting and important, right, Ben?
Yeah, that is one of the most interesting parts of the separation, because if you are a religious institution in the U.S., then you're not paying taxes. And that's why so many organizations fight so ardently to be recognized as a religious institution. Shout out Scientology. But a lot has been made of the so-called religious foundation of the U.S. And in many ways, that's a myth. Like, I love that you mentioned the Pledge of Allegiance, the idea of the phrase under God being in the Pledge of Allegiance. This wasn't part of the pledge until relatively recently, until June of 1954. They went back and added the phrase under God in there. And then you can also see that the founders and the leaders of the early U.S. were pretty adamant about the secular position of the country as a concept. This was kind of seen as heretical by a lot of other places, but it's a cool idea. It means that in theory, if you live in the U.S., you can practice whatever religion you please. You can make a religion up or discover it, however you want to say, and then you can practice that as long as your religious practices don't result in harming others or breaking laws, then you should be all gravy. And of course, you know, that wasn't the same in practice. There was a lot of prejudice against people of the Catholic faith, for instance, or against people practicing Judaism. And that anti-Semitism continues today. But like, the big thing is, they essentially said, look, unless you have a religion that requires you to like murder someone once a month or burn down someone's house twice a year, you'll be fine. But we will prosecute you for murder or arson, so step lightly.
Sure. And that honestly, you're not being hyperbolic there, because it honestly does take something that extreme for any kind of intervention to come down. I mean, it depends, varying degrees of that. But like, for example, not to get too into it, but like, you know, the Church of Scientology has pretty much been proved to have injured people psychologically and possibly, you know, physically, in terms of what happened to David Miscavige's wife. You know, we don't know, but it doesn't seem good. And yet they have maintained that tax exempt status, which is allows them to like buy up all this real estate and have this like absolute stronghold in, you know, California and that part of the country.
Mm-hmm. And there's another interesting turn here, because nowadays when you hear people talk about the separation of church and state, you'll hear people phrasing this as a way of protecting the government from undue influence that would turn it into a theocracy. But back in the day, the rationalization was flipped. Roger Williams, the guy who founded Rhode Island, argued that you needed to have a separation between state and religion, because if you didn't, the government would get involved in the church and corrupt it and make it worldly. And so it's an interesting flip. But I think we can all agree in the modern day, this is a very good distinction to have. It benefits more people than it hurts. But there was another question hanging in the air, and it was one that was not addressed in nearly as clear-cut a manner. How do we handle the relationship between business and the state? Should there be a separation between business and state the same way there's a separation between church and state? And if so, what form would it take? It's a sticky question. It doesn't always have a clear answer.
No, it doesn't. And it's one of these things where it all comes down to, like, how bad do you want to attract industry, you know, as a state? Like, here in Georgia, we had some pretty controversial, you know, very lucrative tax credits for the film industry that ultimately resulted in Georgia becoming, like, you know, location number one for film, because, you know, obviously, like, Atlanta and different parts of the state, you know, you've got a really wide variety of, like, shooting location types and all that. So it made sense already. But, you know, the tax credits that we laid out were massive. So you could argue, like, we're taking a bath on that in terms of, like, lost tax revenue, but it's an exchange between losing out there and gaining jobs and, you know, pumping that industry's money into the economy. So you can make an argument in both directions. But again, this is one example of American governments trying different approaches to this relationship, trying to minimize corruption on the part of, you know, CEOs and politicians, but at the same time trying to maintain a relationship with industry, a cozy relationship, but also one with, like, boundaries, right?
Yeah, I mean, think about it. It's strange. The government depends on partnerships with private businesses for so many things, for countless things. And it's a relationship that has accelerated as time goes on. Like, if you think about it now, the practice of subcontracting projects to various corporations occurs at virtually every level of government in tons of different ways. Most famous, infamous example is the world of the military. Private military contractors vie for contracts to build new hardware, to conduct research, to supply infrastructure, and even soldiers, right? Shout out academia and so on. If you name the task, there's probably some sort of private company involved somewhere in the supply chain. And it's so normalized and the practice is so common that it can be difficult for a lot of people to imagine any other sort of situation. What does a separation of business and state mean? Does it mean the government should interfere less in the day-to-day activities of businesses of any size? If interaction continues, like, there are things that are very important to the government, taxing businesses, and there are things that are very important to the people, like environmental regulations, when do they stop? And what about lobbying? Lobbying is weird. Lobbying is a legalized system of bribery, basically. Is that a hot take? I feel like that's accurate.
I think it's completely accurate. I think we've both shared that opinion in the past on the show. Lobbying is absolutely that. It's essentially like a direct line to lawmakers where you essentially give them incentives, whether it's, you know, an industry that you represent that will donate to their campaigns or what have you, or a constituency, you know, that represents of the workers, perhaps, of the industry that you represent, that will keep this person in power. And it allows you to shape policy that benefits you. Yeah, I think that's accurate, Ben. It's definitely legalized bribery.
And if we're being extreme about it, we could even say that lobbying itself is a conspiracy taking place on a daily basis in Washington, D.C. and other state capitals. So what if there was some alternative model? That's what we're talking about today. For years on this show, I've kind of sketched out this somewhat dystopian model of human evolution. But I always saw it like this. If you look at how people interact in groups and what the primary model of a group interaction is, humans started way back in the day with the family. And then that grew into the tribe, the larger family and community. And that grew into the religion, which would unite people regardless of whether or not they were biologically related. And then that grew into the state, which united people regardless of whether or not they shared the same religion or family. And what's next? For many people, it appears to be the corporation. And folks have been concerned about this for a long, long time, that the nation state would enter decay as a concept. More people would find themselves governed by private industry. And for a lot of folks, understandably, this felt like science fiction. You don't have to look far in science fiction to see a world where the corporation fulfills the function of the state, like the Alien franchise, Blade Runner, the RPG game Shadowrun. I mean, it's corporation as government is an idea a lot of people have been thinking about. And it's not as crazy as it might sound. In fact, it may be closer than we think when we get to the rise of something that is called the innovation zone. What are we talking about? Is this the next step toward a world of science fiction? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. Here's where it gets crazy. So the Nevada Independent broke this story in February, but it's based on statements made by Nevada Governor Steve Sisolak in his January State of the State address, which is a hilarious name, but then also in some later press conferences. And Noel, I think we both watched some of these, right?
Yeah, there was one that I saw. You may have seen the same one. It was about 45 minutes long, and it was broadcast by the Independent on YouTube. It was a live stream of a Zoom. And, you know, it was kind of dry at times, but it was Sisolak and a few experts kind of from his cabinet talking about what this innovation zone situation is and what it would mean for Nevada. And he in that original public address, he kind of dropped that term and didn't really go into much detail. And then some of these press conferences that we're talking about, the detail stuff does come out. We're going to get to that. But he kind of initially gave this overview of like, here are some of these things that we're considering. This move could potentially create 200,000 new jobs. It's a really great thing for Nevadans. But the proposal itself held a little something more, I don't know, I think you and I might argue sinister and a little less blue sky, kind of rosy outlook. One particular proposal by a company called Blockchains LLC, but you can figure out what they do, was being passed around in the state legislature. It talks about the innovation zone being this, a place where a private company becomes the local government.
Yeah, they don't say it that in such a nutshell. That encapsulated phrase is a little bit of me editorializing, but that is what it is. And that's not a hot take. This also, as you say, came out not as an official announcement, but as a leak. At the very same time, Sisolak's administration was talking about how great this would be for the financial and economic future of Nevada. The Nevada Independent said, this is, quote, a plan to create a semi-autonomous county that slowly assumes powers of the county it's based in. And then furthermore, in Blockchain's case, it would be supported by its own currency, a cryptocurrency they're calling stablecoin, which I feel like is optimistic. And shout out to everybody. We're recording this on April 16th. Shout out to everybody who had a little Dogecoin. I hear it reached a dollar. So onward and upward.
This, yeah. No, I took a bath on some crypto yesterday. Ugh.
Oh, no.
Nothing insane. There's this coin called XRP that was kind of like booming. And I got in and then I kind of didn't look at it for a day and then went back and looked at it and it had gone down like 25%. But thus, you know, that's how it goes.
Vegas, baby.
It is Vegas. It really is. And that's why it's ironic, or not ironic at all, that it's crypto that's kind of, you know, being positioned as like, this is going to be the hub of the blockchain technology. And in that press conference that we watched, they make a case as to why The technology itself is separate from cryptocurrency in particular, specifically, which is true because blockchain technology can be used for all kinds of verifications. It can be used for like chains of title, you know, contracts. And property. It's all about contracts. It's all about these smart contracts. And that's kind of why people are betting on it being kind of like the wave of the future, because so many things that we do in terms of chain of custody for whether it's like, you know, any kind of property, it's all based in like handwritten records and deeds and things that exist in like paper form, you know, in like courthouses and in filing cabinets. So it's very imprecise, and there is a lot of opportunity in this technology to do things like that outside of the whole crypto thing. But again, it obviously mainly now is associated with crypto, which very much is its own kind of Vegas baby. But the thing that's so interesting about this blockchain proposal is they want to create a smart city that's powered by this blockchain technology. What that actually means is not perfectly clear yet, but they would apparently purchase 67,000 acres of private land. They made that very clear in the press conference. This is all private land. So it's not like they're going to be able to swoop in and eminent domain, you know, your house yet. But the 67,000 acres of undeveloped desert land east of Reno, Nevada, at the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center. And they've been kicking around this plan for years. Jeffrey Burns, who's the founder of Blockchains, announced the plan to build a blockchain-oriented city back in 2018. Ages ago. And this was at a conference, you know, one of those super rich people influencer, you know, conferences in Prague. So they have things like that.
Yeah. So this shows us a pattern. This plan was kind of announced by Sisolak to the public way after it was already in the works. What's interesting about his statements there in Prague back in 2018, as he said, he's not a developer, but he went on to sell this idea in a high-level way. Blockchain is arguing that the current rules that dictate how existing municipal governments can work are too inflexible for the kind of revolutionary project they want to create here. And yes, I can't be the only one who clocked the provocative use of the word revolutionary. So it goes, like, it's been portrayed by Nevada's administration as similar to your example of Atlanta, right? Like a tax incentive that will ultimately result in a trade-off where the state gains more than it loses. But this goes so much further. If this goes through, if blockchains and other tech companies have their innovation zones in Nevada, then they will take over the functions of your local government. They will be collecting the taxes. They will be running schools for kindergartners through high school. They'll be in charge of infrastructure, maintenance services, and more. And this is where we have to pause for a check-in. This should be interesting to sci-fi fans, policy wonks alike. How would you feel if you knew you still had to pay federal taxes, right? Because you live in the U.S. and you're not a billionaire. You still had to pay state taxes because you live in the U.S. and you're not a billionaire. But those taxes go through this private company. This private company that, by the way, probably employs you. Would you be comfortable with that? Would you feel like it's more streamlined? Would it feel like too much control? I don't know.
It's a good question. I mean, you could argue that it does streamline things, and that if they're the primary, you know, mover, or the same way like the Gaming Commission, obviously that's a government entity, but it's also like holds the keys to the kingdom. You know what I mean? In so many ways for gaming in Nevada. So therefore the keys to like the state. I mean, I'm sure there's like manufacturing and other industry in Nevada, but clearly gaming is a massive source of revenue for the state. And this, they're hoping that this will, they even mentioned that, like the governor in that press conference saying how they wanted to pivot away from just being a gaming state and having this other thing being this like new central kind of incubator or something like that. Or like, in other words, like attracting jobs and talent and, you know, just like something that's on the cutting edge that's going to put Nevada on the map outside of just being, you know, Sin City.
Yeah, well, that's another question, too. Like, let's say you have a family in one of these zones, and your, do you think your kid would still receive a decent, unbiased education if it, that education was administered by a private company? Like, what if your kid does a science project in 10th grade on the environmental dangers of Bitcoin mining or cryptocurrency processing? But, you know, that's a, maybe that feels a little alarmist or sensationalized, but it's a possibility that's in the cards. We can tell you a little bit more about the specifics of the innovation zone proposals, according to these leaks. First, it's kind of expensive to get started. Your average mom and pop falafel stand is not going to be able to start an innovation zone in Nevada. The land can only be created by a private developer who owns more than 50,000 acres of land. That's why Sislak was being so emphatic when he was saying this is private land that they bought, because he wanted to make it clear it's not the government giving this land away. They're buying this land already, so they made a private landowner a ton of money at like from day one, square zero, day zero, square one. You guys get it. So, secondly, this company that wants to become your new government has to promise to invest up to $1 billion in their zone over time. That's also a ton of money. That's way more money than is in the banana stand or the falafel stand. And then they have to agree to a specific tax on whatever innovative technology the zone specializes in. So this is something I think they talked a lot about in the press conference you were mentioning, Noel, like the tax incentives, but also for blockchains, LLC, they would need to somehow have a tax program on the technology that they're concentrating on in their new government, which would be blockchain. And they've got a very long-term plan here with some ambitious goals, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, they do. They plan to break ground in 2020 and over a 75-year period develop what they're calling Painted Rock Smart City that would conceptually be home to 36,000 permanent residents. And eventually they plan to employ one out of every 50 residents of the state of Nevada.
Crazy.
Which would account for almost 2% of wages produced in the entire state.
Which doesn't sound like a lot until you realize it's the entire state. It's 2% of a very, very big number. And I know what we're thinking. Some of our fellow conspiracy realists in the crowd today, maybe some of the more ambitious of us. I don't know what the problem is, guys. This sounds fantastic. Can I start an innovation zone? We'll talk a little bit more about that after the break. And we're back. So for some of those of us in the crowd today who consider themselves maybe a little more proactive, more go-getterish, you may have already started thinking, just like Bender in Futurama, yeah, I'll start my own government with blackjack and other vices, etc. Which is funny because Vegas already has those. And your question is, how do I get started? Well, first, you have to find the land. You have to have control of 50,000 contiguous acres of undeveloped property, and it has to be located in a single county. There can't be any permanent residents there at the time, and it can't be part of any pre-existing city, town, or what they call governmental division established by law. So you can't take over an existing town. You have to build it from scratch. And you have to submit an application, of course, because it's, you know, government bureaucracy.
Next, you're going to need to include 9 different things on your application to the Governor's Office of Economic Development. And that's stuff like a plan for future development, an estimate for construction and future employment, documents that prove that you have sufficient funds to invest, $250 million just to start, and $1 billion over 10 years, an economic impact statement, certification that a qualified developer has gotten and held or can obtain access to public utilities and natural resources that are needed to complete the project. And then you also have to kind of specialize. Each zone has to be tied, like we've been saying kind of from the start, to a very specific industry, or more specifically, innovative technology, and be able to levy that or be able to levy an industry-specific tax that we also mentioned earlier. Things like robotics, AI, biometrics, you know, biomedical technology, clean energy, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Autonomous vehicles would be another one. All of these things that you hear about in tech-specific TED Talks, honestly. So let's say you get all this done and you get approved. Boom, boom, boom. You also gain control over things that a county-level government or a municipality would ordinarily control. As your new corporate county grows, you can just let the existing Nevada county know when you're ready. You don't have a hard timeline. You just let them know when you feel like taking on the responsibilities of having a police force or firefighters, wastewater treatment, healthcare, get this, a judicial system, an education. And eventually, when the zone is ready, they will assume all of the authority of the existing county in which they reside. That means that at some point, the innovation zone itself is no longer subject to county ordinances. What about voting? Once there are 100 eligible permanent residents living in that zone, the zone can organize its own elections. And in the case of blockchain's proposed city specifically, because of the nature of their innovation, it's paving the way to have its own currency. So like imagine 120 years from now, you find yourself traveling to Nevada, you stop by Painted Rock, which is going to be the name of their city, and you find that your U.S. dollars or your Paul pounds or whatever they'll end up being called at that time have to be converted, because every store, every shop, every place in the zone only accepts payment in stablecoin. They haven't said that's going to happen. It's just a possibility. And to me, it is darkly hilarious. But that's the other question, too. You know, Noel, is this moving forward, right, to the future, whether for good or for ill, or is this simply returning to an idea we've tried in the past? It reminds me of a story that's maybe not too familiar to some of our folks in the audience today. But years ago, when I was hosting a wonderful little show called Car Stuff, we went on a road rally together. And one of the things that road rally led us to was a night in a real life corporate run town, or it was corporate run at one point. It was Hershey, Pennsylvania. Yes, run by the Hershey Chocolate Company. Remember that place? They had the car museum?
Of course. It was wonderful. Great car museum. Really wonderful trip. The old road rally. I actually found a koozie from that road rally the other day, and it brought back fond memories. It makes me think of things, though. Like, I mean, again, this idea that I'm about to put forward is maybe a little of an extreme example, but it's like mining towns and like the company store and all that, right? You know, where you work for the same and are paid for the same people that sell you the things that you need to survive, which inherently has this kind of conflict of interest vibe, mm-hmm. which this does too. Like, you know, it feels like they have a little too much control, and the idea of, you know, they're collecting the taxes that are being taken out of your pay. That's weird, right? Like, I don't know. Maybe I'm being alarmist, but it just seems mm-hmm. like it's going right back into their coffers in a way that's a little bit strange.
So you see it more as a kind of like resurrection of the idea of the company town. That's what the 16 Tons song is about. And this Hershey was a company town. There have been many of these throughout American history. You can visit them. You can visit them now as kind of historical sites, right? But back in the day, it wasn't super uncommon for the entirety of a town's population, working population, to be employed by the same company. And that same company also owned all the stores, all the places you could spend your money. They also, in a very real way, owned the money. You weren't paid in U.S. currency. You were paid in what was called scrip. Right. So they were economically locking the residents of a town in and exercising great control over their day to day activities, even if they were not on the clock. And from the perspective of Nevada's government, this is a powerful tax incentive. It's a way to prime the pump and help residents who, I mean, it's inarguable, help residents who desperately need new, reliable sources of long-term employment. But how far does this plan go? How much mission creep slips in here? Are future citizens of Nevada going to find themselves becoming citizens of a corporation more so than a state? There are two other disturbing facts here, saved for the end. It doesn't help the image or the optics that the PR people would call it, that Blockchains LLC donated heavily to Governor Sisolak during the last campaign cycle. They gave the man $60,000 for his campaign. And critics will also tell you that Nevada politicians are kind of easily influenced, or they have a lower price tag. And then, you know, Nevada already does have a lot of land deals with big corporations. The second one we have to get to is who makes the day-to-day decisions in this zone. Technically, it's not the CEO of Blockchains, unless that CEO is one of the board members running the zone. There's a three-person board that has to run every single innovation zone that's created. Is the board elected? No, they're not elected. If you live in the zone, you have no control over who lives, who dies, who tells your story, who runs your government. The three people who ultimately make the decisions are appointed. They are not elected by you. So who are these people?
And it's funny, too. I mean, like I said, on that press conference, the Zoom thing, the governor is just evangelizing for these people. You know, and when you find out that that $60,000 donation from this corporation to the governor, and you see how just rosy a picture he's painting, given all of the, I mean, again, I don't think we're being alarmist here. I think there are real potential pitfalls here. As we know, when it, every time you, the more power you give corporations, or the more closer things come to a monopoly, the less individuals benefit, it seems to me. It's more like, you know, the people at the very, very top benefit. And sure, you know, Amazon's great. We can get like stuff in 5 seconds, you know, crap that we don't need. But at the end of the day, it is like almost monopoly. Like, no, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to go too off the track here, but to me, Amazon started to feel like a company store kind of situation too. When they get so big and they literally just start taking over swaths of like whole towns. It reminds me of like the Augusta National in Augusta, Georgia, for example, which is where I grew up. It's obviously this famous golf course. They, for years, were just trying to buy up every piece of property around that golf course. And there were a few lone holdouts, but they've got time, and they ultimately got what they wanted. And now I can't even recognize my hometown anymore. It all feels like Golf Disney World.
But they still kept those sandwiches at a very low price.
But that's just all the mythology and the smoke and mirrors of the Nav of the Masters. It's like, oh, we're folksy. And it's like, oh, we have egg salad sandwiches for a dollar or whatever. Yeah, okay. But you know, that's what I'm saying, though. Like, when you get to a point where you have so much money you can throw around, you really can own pretty much whatever you want.
Exactly.
It's not hard to get politicians to fall in line.
Right. And that's what I'm getting to when I'm talking about this three-person board, because we don't know, there aren't specific people elected to the board, because this is just draft legislation. It's a proposal. It hasn't gone through yet. But here's how it breaks down. So there are three people running the board. One of them is appointed by the governor, which would be Sisolak at this point. The company gets to appoint the other two members, which is far past any other conflict of interest that we've talked about before. This reminds me like of one of the most famous, I would say qualifies as a company town, the Reedy Creek Improvement District, aka the semi-autonomous state of the Disney Corporation in Florida. These are company towns. I think you make a good argument about Augusta National as well. This is probably going to happen, folks. And we'll have people in the audience who disagree on whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Looking at the facts, I think, Noel, you and I can agree that there's much more opportunity for corruption and conspiracy than there is for progress and the betterment of the life of the average Nevada resident. This sets off my spidey sense, and not in the best way, but what do you think, folks? Are we being alarmists? Obviously, we don't think we are, but could this lead to a situation where some members of the U.S. public feel like they're U.S. citizens, and then other people feel like they have two types of citizenship, one for, you know, Uncle Sam, right? And one for Amazon, or one for blockchains. I could totally see Amazon buying a town. Like, you don't have to have all of the legal framework to do some of these things in practice. Like, think about Walmart. Walmart can hold a town hostage if it's the largest employer, right? And they can close down something for trying to unionize, or they can threaten politicians by saying, look, we'll just pick up our tent stakes and go somewhere else. Off air, when we were talking in preparation for this episode, I think we both noted the rose-colored glasses the governor of Nevada is wearing. This had some, what do I call it? This had some big Simpsons monorail vibes. You know what I mean?
Like, oh my
this
gosh, yes.
Will solve everything, but will it? I don't think so.
It'll solve a lot of stuff for blockchains, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's certainly a new chapter in corporate dominance. Kind of, you know what I mean? Now they get there. I mean, you know, and like, again, like the picture painted by the governor and his cronies is like, this is the city of the future. Nevada will be ground zero for the city of the future. Again, monorail vibes. You're totally right. But here's a question to end on. Why do they need to have their own government? Why can't what's already in place with regulation? Doesn't it inherently seem like they're trying to circumvent regulation by setting up their own system where they regulate themselves? Like, where's the oversight? Again, I know that the governor would appoint someone, but obviously the governor's in, you know, blockchain's pocket, no question. I mean, I think.
Yeah, I'm tempted to agree, because the leaked proposal talks about how the current governmental structure at the county level is too, quote unquote, inflexible. Mm-hmm. For it to work, and how this would be a better alternative. But what does inflexible mean? They don't really get into the specifics to defend that statement. But, you know, let us know what you think, folks. Let us know what you think the answers to these questions are. Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Would you like to live in a corporatocracy, right? Would you like to live in a place where your government is, you know, the primary employer and a private company that is not beholden to give you some of the same rights that you would currently have as a U.S. citizen? We want to know your thoughts. Thanks to everyone who wrote in to bring this to our attention. And we'd especially like to thank the first listener who suggested this to us. So shout out to you, the Cat in the Black Hat. I am loving these nicknames, folks. It makes me, I don't know, I love it when people come with a nickname.
I love a nickname, and I love a good story behind the nickname too. So let us know, how'd you get your nickname? You can write to us on the internet, on the Facebook and the Twitter, where we're Conspiracy Stuff. We are Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram.
Yes, you can also, if you don't sip the social meds, give us a call directly. We are 1-833-STDWYTK. Give us a message. Tell us what's on your mind. Give us a cool nickname. Let us know if we can use your name and or voice on air. And please don't censor yourself. If 3 minutes doesn't feel like enough time, then write out the entire story. Send it to us. We read every email we get. We'd always love to hear from you. You can send us one at our good old-fashioned email address, where we are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.